Good evening, everyone. Again, we are pleased to welcome you to Métis Voices Radio, our own internet radio program at BBS Radio, every Friday evening, 7:55 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, Station 2, with your host, Dale Haggerty, live from the Machif Métis Museum in beautiful Vavenby, B.C., Canada. Our program features a variety of subjects and special guests each week. Tonight, we are pleased to have Marshall Lowen, Captain of the Hunt. Call-in lines are now open, as well as a chat feature for your questions and comments. Here are the numbers to call. In the U.S. and Canada, toll-free 888-228-4494. And worldwide, toll-free 877-489-6350. For direct lines, go to the www.bbsradio.com, BBS Station 2 on the right-hand side. And those who wish to enter the BBS live chat rooms, you now need to access it by the homepage of the BBS Radio. On the left-hand side, scroll down, click into How to Listen, and then scroll down to Chat Live, BBS My Chat Rooms. Click in, choose the drop-down menu, select the chat room chatter hall. Sign in if already registered, or register if you haven't already. And here's Dale Haggerty.
Hey, everyone. It's Vendredi Juan Lacis, which means in the Michif language, Friday, June the 6th. Tonight, I have the privilege of introducing to you as my guest, a good friend, elder Métis brother, Marshall Lowen, Captain of the Hunt. Welcome to our show, Marshall.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Well, Marshall, can you tell us a little bit about you growing up and your family life in Winnipeg and the many places that you lived? And did you grow up in the Métis community?
Well, I originally started my life out in a suburb of Winnipeg, which is called St. James, on the banks of the Assiniboine River, which was our ancestral home. The interesting thing was, although I, there were native things happening around me, and I was aware of the native people and also of our family, it wasn't until I was about 12 years old when I met a lady by the name of Barbara Johnston. And Barbara, very fascinating woman. At the time, she was what we would call the custodian of the Hudson's Bay Museum. And at that time, the Hudson's Bay Museum was in the store on Portage Avenue in Winnipeg. And later on, they closed the museum in 61, and I guess the Manitoba government took over the Hudson's Bay Archives and that. But up to that time, she was a lady who more or less acquainted me with my heritage. It was pretty well denied by anybody in our family because, as I said to you before, basically there were sort of two groups. There were the English half-breeds and the French half-breeds. And as one of the interesting things is we were separated by the river. We were separated by the church, and in some ways we were separated by the language. But she was the one who basically acquainted me with what was happening, and I had friends who were Machif, I had friends who were Bungie. It was sort of a joke. We never talked about Bungie or Machif. It was people who spoke French or people who spoke English with sort of a Gaelic or Scottish accent. So that's sort of, how I sort of got into it. As far as my heritage as far as hunting and trapping. It was something that I picked up from my grandfathers and my uncles, different friends of mine at school and one thing and another. But it didn't really come to the forefront about, you know, having Métis heritage.
Tell us about the bungee. The, you mentioned that for our listeners out there that, you know, yeah, you knew this question was coming up, Marshall. I know it.
I know.
Because, you know,
well,
as
we always
cultural,
laugh about it.
Yeah, go
it's,
ahead.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting because it up until about, oh, I'd say 1875 in Red River, it was basically known as the, you know, basically the Red River dialect. As I say, we were separated, you know, basically by the river there with most of the French-speaking people over in St. Boniface or in Fort Rouge. And when we looked at it, you know, it was a language that incorporated a lot of, oh, I would say Scottish or Gaelic accents, but it also basically took Chippewa language, or as they, I guess they call it now, Anishinaabe, and mixed it up with English, just like Machif was a mixture of French and Cree.
Listen, Marshall, we've got a caller on the line. Go ahead, caller. Can
yeah.
you give his name?
Hello? Fort Rouge. And when we looked at it, you know, it was a language that incorporated a lot of...
Hello? Can you speak up?
What?
Can you give us your name?
Earl Belcourt.
Oh, hi, Earl. You got a question for Marshall?
Well, just a couple of comments, actually. I've been listening to him over here, and I'd just like to tell Marshall that you're not too far from home there, from Senior Stash, Manitoba. So you must know where that is, Marshall.
Oh, I certainly do. Certainly do.
Yeah, and I understand everything you've been saying here involving, especially what you said about Fort Rouge.
Yeah.
Well, in St. Eustache, Manitoba, there's a separation there. You know, the highway that goes from Ely to Marquette there? Up
yeah.
By Trans-Canada?
Right.
Okay, well, on the left-hand side, when you're going down that way, there's St. Eustache downtown over there. And you know how small that place is. And on the right-hand side is Fort Rouge. We used to call it, you said Fort Rouge. We used to call it Fort Rouge. And on the left, dark Métis used to live, and on the left-hand side was where the white Métis used to live. And so we're not too far apart, you and I.
No, we're not. You know, one of my very good friends was our elder who's passed away, Rosalie Huston. And then Rosalie, we used to talk all the time, you know, about basically enjoying our differences. Because, you see, when I guess I was about 12 or 13, I moved over to Fort Garry. And I had a girlfriend across the river, basically in St. Patel. So... you know, we were talking about, you know, how do we get back and forth, and I had a canoe in summertime because if we had to go by the bridge, then I had to go all the way back into, you know, into Winnipeg and then cross, you know, across the bridge and over there. So it was a lot shorter just to take the canoe over there. And, of course, later on in the year, the river would freeze up, and, of course, you had to be a brave person to basically... be the first one across the river and not end up in the middle of the river, you know, where it frees up. And then, of course, the trick was to be the last person across before breakup. But, we had lots of friends there. And later on, I lived in St. Boniface. So, you know, it was sort of a natural thing. You know, the people we grew up with, it wasn't until... I started later on in life to look at Métis heritage and basically find we had some interesting bloodlines and some interesting relatives that nobody ever talked about.
Oh, yeah, I'm looking at your biography or whatever it is that you want to call it here on the Internet here, and it said Silver Heights. Well, my wife and I stayed in Silver Heights when we first met. you know, in
the
Sturgeon Creek area, and I mean, we know all those areas, and St. James and St. Charles, and St. Charles, as a matter of fact, you know, used to be a Métis community before Winnipeg and Croton, eh?
Yeah.
By the way, I was going to ask you another question here. Do you know the name Dan LaFrance?
Oh, Dan LaFrance, yeah. Dan LaFrance, he was actually the one that originally appointed me as Captain of the Hunt for Region 1 down here, which was later confirmed, you know, by our community. But I haven't run into Dan for quite a few years. Last time I heard he was up in the Caribou.
No, he's in Whistler now, and he's my campaign manager, so you'll be hearing from him quite a bit.
Oh, good, good. Well, I look forward to, you know, renewing our friendships. You know,
he's quite the guy, and I'm hoping that you guys will renew your friendship since I'm running for president. So.
Ah. Well, that's good news. Certainly, we need some good people in there, and it's about time, you and I talked years back, but, hopefully we can get together in the near future.
Oh, we will. We need to fight for our rights. There's no doubt about it. I mean, the people have done a good job, but I don't want to get into politics. It's not a political station, so I just thought I'd call and say hello and reintroduce it.
Well, thanks for the call, Earl. It's been nice hearing your voice again.
Well, listen, Earl, and Marshall, as a matter of fact, I just got off the phone just prior to the show starting, and I did talk to Dan. And he'll be on probably in about 2 weeks. And Marshall, he also said to say hi, and he remembers the time. So he just says to say hello and send his greeting to you. And thanks, Earl, for coming along and making your comments. That's really good. And I'm glad that more Métis people are interested on our program and making sure that, you know, our voice is being carried. Thanks, Earl.
You're more than welcome, Dale, and I can tell you right now that more and more people in Canada are listening to your radio station, and we really do welcome all the people here, especially the people like Marshall I can't even remember her name now, and she was a good friend of mine, too. That lovely lady, there she is right there. My goodness.
Rosalie.
Teresa Dion. And Rosalie, too, as a matter of fact. She was a lovely lady. I loved her very much, very much. I miss her, as a matter of fact. And So anyway, have a good weekend and take care of yourself.
Yeah, okay,
thanks, Earl. There you go. There you go, Marshall. How's that for a comment, eh?
Well, that's always good. It's nice to hear that old friends and are listening and participating. It's great.
That's right. So getting back to this, so now you're 15 years old. Now tell us about this book that you wrote.
Well, what was interesting was, of course, one of the things I used to do was, haunt along the Winnipeg River. I had all sorts of places where I used to canoe and that, and I was quite interested in the culture of the fur trade and what happened and one thing and another, and I ended up knowing quite a bit about, the area of Winnipeg River and up Lac de Bonnie, Pointe du Bois, down to Seven Sisters, that area, and Barbara, she got hold of me and said, as a kid in school, that, you should get some of your stuff down in writing. So she got me to write for, I think it's, it was the Historical Society at that time, and got me to write down my thoughts and how I did things and where we were. There was interesting things going on at that time. There was people coming out from Royal Ontario Museum looking at the area of, where the fur trade went through there. And I was pretty good at finding old Indian encampments and arrowheads and broken pottery, all sorts of stuff. So So I guess one of the interesting things they used to do was send out these archaeologists, and of course, as a kid, you know, to have them take you out, you know, in their boats, and, you know, can you show us where there was an Indian camp here, or can you show us where there was a, you know, fur trade post? So it was quite interesting, and as I say, it sort of boggled my mind a couple of years ago when I thought, it's interesting. I was looking up some history, and I thought, oh, heck, there can't be two Marshall Lowens out there. Some guy has written a book, you know. And then I looked at it and realized there was one that I had basically written at 15 years of age. So kind of interesting.
Oh.
Sort of brought that out. But Barbara Johnson, she passed away back in 2003, but she went on from there to take over. She was appointed superintendent of the National Park at Lower Fort Garry. And she was actually the first woman in Canada to ever be named to such a position. And what she did is she participated in the fort's restoration. And, of course, that has a lot of our history because, of course, that's where Riel was and, that's where Scott was executed. I got to run around there, and it was also interesting because about the same time, about a year or so later, I got involved in the military, and I joined a militia unit in Winnipeg, which was the Fort Garry Horse. Of course, that runs contrary to, Métis history, because they participated at Batoche. Of course, they weren't on our side.
Yeah, so when did they dismantle Fort Garry? Can you tell us about that a little bit? Because all I've heard right now that's going on is they're trying to save the front gates of Fort Garry.
Oh, okay. Well, basically, there were two forts. There was Fort Garry, which was basically at the Forks. If you know Winnipeg, it's close to where the Fort Garry Hotel is.
Okay.
And that was basically in downtown Winnipeg. That was dismantled, I'd say back in the late 1800s, and all that was basically left was the gate. But, you see, Stone Fort was the one that was down basically north of Lockport, between Lockport and Selkirk.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the big Stone Fort.
Okay.
So, now I guess not too up on what's happening in Winnipeg these days, but yeah, I understand that they're trying to preserve that. The interesting part was the Fort Garry Horse, their cap badge, has the gate of the main fort as part of their cap badge.
Yeah. So where did the provisional government actually, which fort was it? Was it the Stone Fort or was it the other one?
Oh, you got me now, but I know that it must have been the Stone Fort. That's where I remember being, looking at the site with Barbara Johnston, and I believe that's where, Scott was executed, and I believe that's where the, the dissenters or what were held prisoner, Bolton and those guys.
Oh, I see, yeah. Okay. Right on.
Yeah.
So tell us about the book.
Well, it was just basically a pretty short, little epistle on how I went about finding arrowheads and implements and stuff like that. And, of course, it wasn't rocket science, but, I mean, let's face it, an encampment, any type of camp, had to have certain things like, water, shelter, from the wind. And, of course, the same things we look in a good campsite today, they were looking at 100 years ago. But one of the things that I found that was kind of interesting was the proliferation of oak trees in areas where oak trees didn't normally grow. And I noticed this. Part of this came from the native people ate acorns as part of their diet. And, of course, they would take them wherever they went, and I guess wherever they were camping or whatever, through one thing or another, the oak trees started to shoot up. And one of the other ones was, of course, the local people there, unlike the Plains Indians, actually made pottery. So we were able to, you know, along the banks of the river, be able to find out where the pottery shards were, where, you know, the women would go down to get water or whatever, and possibly break the pots or whatever. And also, you know, we went through the idea of, you know, working, you know, with flint and with stones for arrowheads. And I actually had one of the native elders demonstrate to me how they did flint knapping. So I learned that along with skinning and trapping and that from, you know, a lot of the people along the, you know, lived along the Winnipeg River.
Well, listen, I guess that's why, you know, you're talking about the oak trees and that. Now I'm just looking back at some of the history that when I was looking it up, that they built a lot of the Red River carts out of the oak, didn't they?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, they used it because... Go ahead.
Yeah, it's a hard, durable wood. But, you know, it's interesting because I always look at sort of parts of history that other people overlook. And, I mean, we all know about the Red River carts. But, you know, the interesting thing about the prairies is, you know, about 6 months of the year you've got snow and ice.
That's
and
right.
Very little is really written about the Red River sleds.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah. Well, the interesting part is up at Fort Alexander, they didn't have roads. And a lot of times what they did in those areas was they used sleds even in the summertime. Because the wheels wouldn't work in the bush.
It was so
too
muddy.
The side of the river. Yeah, well, that and, you know, with the brush and one thing and another. And there was basically a version of the equivalent of, call it a winterized Red River cart, which was the Red River sled.
Never knew that.
So, yeah.
Knew they had sleds, though, but I never knew that. So possibly what they could do is they could convert an actual Red River cart rolling into a sled.
Yeah, with runners underneath it. Yeah.
Wow, unbelievable! That is some history that I'm just learning now. But I knew that, like I said, they had a sled, but I never knew that. I thought it was completely built from a different. You know, a new project sort of thing, not knowing they would have just converted the Red River cart by just removing the wheels and putting on the sleighs, on the runners.
Well, you know, when I was younger, there were still people in, in the Manitoba-Ontario boundary who were still doing what I call marginal logging. And, of course, what they were doing was, a lot of it was poplar logs. Because the poplar trees, you know, were fast-growing, and they grew a lot bigger. So a lot of the guys who were doing that, they were basically, you know, equivalent of, like, what we had on the farmland, the stone boats, and basically sledges, sleds, which they basically operated basically on the bush roads.
There you go. Yeah, I'm sorry, you know, Marshall, even though that I am a full Métis heritage and all this, I actually hadn't had the privilege of growing up in the prairies, and I grew up in a city, so I never knew all the history, and of course what we learned in school was basically what they wanted us to hear and read, right? So,
well,
yes. A very eye-opening experience is here you're telling me about this, so.
Well, as I say, it gets interesting because, you know, again, you know, when I was a kid, we used to make money by cutting pulpwood and, basically cordwood. And, in those days, we didn't even have chainsaws. It was just done with a swede saw. But, again, you see, that was all stacked on sleds and basically using horses dragged out of the bush. But, you know, that was big business, too, because on the prairies, firewood, was a pretty good commodity. So if a person had, an area of brush or whatever, even when they were clearing the farmland, any of the, poplar, any of the trees, it was always basically, kept for firewood.
Yeah. So you said you were You said you joined the military. Was it a short career in the military, or service, or did you go overseas, or?
Yeah, I joined the militia unit first, and then I spent time with went into regular forces. Spent time with the British and American, with a couple of the joint task forces. But part of what interested me in the military was, you know, basically a lot of the history and, you know, the interesting people. You know, being out of Winnipeg, you know, I was fortunate to know people like Tommy Prince. And, you know, Tommy, you know, there was a guy who, you know, can be used as a role model, you know, for, you know, a lot of people. And I think, you know, there's a cadet corps named after him. There's streets named after him, you know. But, you know, a lot of people today, you know, don't realize, you know, what a, well, I guess a mover and a shaker he was, because, I mean, he was a member, first of all, of the 1st Parachute Regiment here. And then joined the, you know, the 1st American Special Forces. And, of course, he's even portrayed in that movie that they did, you know, on the Devil's Brigade.
Yeah.
And then he was the, I believe, the highest decorated, you know, Aboriginal, you know, soldier of the Second World War. And then he went on to basically go with the PPCLI to Korea. And another person sort of fascinating, you know, to meet was some of our real heroes who had Victoria Crosses. And being in the Fort Garry Horse, we had a fellow by the name of Hark Strawn who won the Victoria Cross in the First World War for what I think was one of the last cavalry charges. If you can imagine, you know, getting on a horse with a bunch of guys and riding into German machine guns and barbed wire and surviving to tell about it. And Harkus is, he passed away, 82, I think. He was 98 years old. So, I mean, they didn't get him in the First World War, and he lived to be a ripe old age. And, you know, meeting people like, you know, Smokey Smith and you know, these sort of people. And I guess what was sort of interesting about it is that I don't think any of these guys ever set out to be heroes, you know.
No.
It was just a matter of circumstance, and, you know, they weren't self-promoters in, you know, what they did. And, you know, it's sort of interesting, you know, the people that you meet and the people who, you know, have impact on your life. And I met a lot of people through the military that I probably wouldn't have met, you know, otherwise.
You're speaking
so,
of spoke there. Did have the privilege of being one with one of my elders, Teresa Dion, which is a veteran. And Teresa, she's quite a character there. And, of course, she always used to make me come to the – she forced us to – actually, not forced us to, but we – you're members of the NAVA, the National Aboriginal Veterans Association, as associate members. And so I had the privilege of lots of times we going down to the BC Stadium there, and Smokey Smith was out there riding in the beautiful cars, and I actually got to shake his hand, and that's an honor and a privilege, you know, to meet veteran war hero sort of things. And like you say, go ahead.
Yeah, it's a humbling experience. And as I say, the thing is that, you know, it for so long, you know, our Aboriginal veterans have, you know, they've had an uphill battle. They haven't, I don't think, been treated fairly. But, you know, if we look at Canada, Canada's an interesting country in the way that I think everybody at one time or another in Canadian history has been discriminated against, right? Whether it be English, Irish, French, Métis, First Nations, the Ukrainian, East Indian, you know, I mean, at some point in our history, somebody has been discriminated against, you know. But that's part of, you know, sort of picking yourself up, dusting yourself off, and being proud of what you are, you know.
Yeah, that's a good point to say that you get up, and there's always that little ditch that you can overcome and climb out of it and move on, sort of thing. So, yeah, you've had I know, Marshall, that you don't, and I don't blame a lot of veterans talking about the wars, because sometimes it was painful. But you really have given me some enlightenment about a military's life of that I didn't know about you, that surprisingly, and really interesting, because I never had the opportunity, because obviously I grew up at the time and when it was peacetime and all the time, so there you go. So, but now tell us about a little bit more about your hunting skills. And I heard that they, one of our dear friends, of course, Dan LaFrance, which was the provincial coordinator of the Captain of the Hunt, has appointed you the Captain of the Hunt of the Lower Mainland, or Region 1. So tell us a little bit.
Yeah, that was a few years ago, and of course it was then affirmed. The Captain of the Hunt is really appointed by the hunters. And, you know, with being the captain of the hunt, there's a responsibility that, you know, the hunting that we carry out is done according to Métis tradition and, you know, the customs. And part of it is that, you know, we put together through the Vancouver Métis community and through our hunters, we put together a couple of guidebooks, and we have our own rules, the things that we do, how things are done, you know, with the animals, with the meat, and, you know, with the whole idea of hunting. And, you know, the hunting, the gathering, the harvesting. And really, when it comes down to it, you know, when we talk about Métis rights, and I've had people say, well, you know, what rights do the Métis have? And I think, first and foremost, it's the right to hunt. You know, the land rights, while they exist in some areas, are going to be very hard things to prove where there's not established, you know, territories. For example, down here in the Lower Mainland, I don't think they're going to give us a big chunk of land because we're Métis. But we're constantly fighting and, you know, putting forth, you know, with our Métis rights that we have Aboriginal rights. And, of course, if we don't practice, we lose them.
That's right. Marshall, there's a caller on line one, I guess. Can you give your name?
Yeah, this is Derek White, Sky Cloud.
Hi, Derek. How are you tonight?
Good.
Good.
I'm
can
thanking
you,
you for bringing on this
Marshall?
Wonderful guest who talks about Winnipeg and Manitoba area. I'm born in Brandon, so I know what the territory is like.
Well, Derek, we won't hold that against you that you're from Brandon. Okay.
Have you noticed, I mean, when's the last time you went back to Winnipeg?
Pardon me, Derek?
When's the last time you were back in Winnipeg?
Ooh, probably about 10 years ago.
Okay, if you went back there, it hasn't changed. So nothing changes. Nobody changes. Somehow Manitoba has a way of, like, it goes into what's called a freeze frame. Nobody moves, nobody changes. The buildings are the same, nobody's moved on. It's just, I left there when I was young, and stayed about 30 years ago. I was there back about 3 years ago, but before that I went back, I left there 30 years ago, I came back and went, nothing's changed. All the buildings are still there, hardly anything has ever been built brand new. You know, you're in that freeze frame, that time frame, it's just, freaks you out.
Yeah, just like a time warp. Well, the interesting thing was my father, he lived in St. James basically, you know, all his life. And he ended up, he bought a house up on, I'm trying to think of the name of the street up there, I guess just off Ness. And I had to laugh because my son ended up, when my dad passed away, my son bought his house. So there's basically been like three generations of us living basically in the same house. So yeah, I think you're right. Nothing changes.
Nothing changed. I mean, even the old military houses are still there on the base and off the bases. They're still. I couldn't believe it. I drove down the street and went, the houses haven't aged. You know, they're just square boxes. That's pretty wild.
Yeah. Well, I always joke and say the best thing to come out of Manitoba was the road to Vancouver. But my dad would say to me, he would say, I don't know how you can stand Vancouver. It rains all the time. And I said, Dad, you don't have to shovel the rain.
It just washes.
I left Manitoba because of 10-foot snowbanks.
Yeah.
When you're driving down the road, all you get is nothing but, you don't get snowbanks up here, but you get 10-foot snowbanks up there because when they put the plows through, they even bury your car. It's crazy. But I remember when I was a kid in the farm also, too, that we had stone boats. I mean, we had a stone boat we used to haul our manure on.
Yeah.
Or you get the horse in front of you, and you're sitting on it, or you're standing on it and hauling onto the field. Those things were heavy.
Yeah.
They were heavy, but they worked.
Yeah. But, the runners we used to make out of smaller poplar, about 6-inch poplar for the runners.
Yeah.
And that was used in the bush because you couldn't get a car in there, you couldn't get a vehicle in there, but if you had a horse, it could basically drag that sled. And one of my other little hobbies is, I collect a lot of books. I've got, old books, on the Red River. I've got, different articles that have been written going back into, the early 1800s. And every once in a while, sometimes on eBay or whatever, you can pick up some of the old journals. And actually, some of the better journals of the times come out of the Dakotas and Minnesota.
Yeah, that's true.
Because that was where, before, they would, basically come through the trails, St. Paul, and, through that area up into Manitoba. And, of course, Hudson's Bay, had that post at Pembina, and then when they brought the boundary line in, they discovered that, Pembina was south of the boundary line, so they packed everything up and basically moved up to... up to the forks, and moved everything up that way.
Remember
I used to call it Pembina.
I think the magazine was called the Harper magazine or something like that.
Harper's Bazaar. Yeah, and they did a lot of articles about the American Civil War, and also at that time. They were also doing stuff on the West, and of course, at the West, of course, in those days, was basically the Dakotas.
Well, there was another magazine that was out way many years before. I'm not sure if it still exists, but it was called The Beaver.
The Beaver was issued by the Hudson's Bay.
Yeah, and that was, in fact, I was out when I was in Winnipeg. I was doing some work up there for a family, and I was actually asked to come out to this house. And this one particular family is not living in it anymore, but the house was abandoned for about 20 years, but it was all locked up as if it was like in condition. But I walked in this house, and that particular family, whoever it was, saved all their newspapers and their magazines. When they bought them, they never burned them or used them. They stacked them all up in the corner. I never seen so many Beaver magazines, and they looked like the size of the old Life magazines back then.
Yeah.
Well, like I said, time stands still. Nobody moves on. It's surprising. I mean, those magazines today are probably worth a lot of money. But I was also going to say, too, that going towards Montana, when I was up in Montana, there was a lot of places that had, like we call it, arrowheads and a lot of camping sites in that area because the Hudson's Bay had a place up in Sweetgrass?
Yeah. Well, of course, there was a big Métis, settlement in Montana because, of course, that's where Riel was teaching school when the guys came down from Batoche and talked them into, becoming the leader.
Yeah.
And it's kind of interesting because I have a book here that I read every once in a while, and it's called North of the Medicine Line. And, you know, it's one of those things that people still use the term in the prairies today. They'll talk about going across the line.
Yeah.
They don't say going across the border. They'll say, oh, I'm going across the line.
That terminology.
Yeah, the First Nations used to refer to it as the medicine line. And, of course, you know, after the Custer battle, when the Lakota came up to Saskatchewan, Manitoba, that was the whole idea was, once we get north of the medicine line, then we're going to be okay. You know, the long knives can't chase us up here. When Sitting Bull and the people came up here, that was the whole idea. You know, was it was an imaginary line, but it was a medicine line.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Never knew that. That's something interesting. Very interesting.
You'll still see people, particularly in the prairies, will talk about it. You know, here we'll say we're going across the border, but in the prairies they'll say you're going across the line.
I use it a lot, and I never knew, but I guess I must have picked it up from the family because, you know, like I said, we lived in Vancouver, of course, you know, and Blaine was there, and we'd say, well, we're just going across the line.
Yeah.
It's funny, and we never even thinking that you're thinking of that, and that's the terminology we use. So obviously there is some confirmation that I must be Métis, eh?
Yeah.
There you go.
Well, the other thing, of course, If you go through southern Manitoba, like when I was younger, and Saskatchewan, you see, when they were, the Border Commission was basically putting in the international border, remember they crossed the prairie, so there were no trees to put stakes in. So what they used to do was they would dig a hole and pile the dirt up. And, you know, through the prairie there, a lot of times that was basically where the international boundary was. You could see the mounds of dirt, you know, within line of sight of one another.
Oh, that's how they did it, yeah.
Yeah.
Stuff.
Kind of.
Thanks, guys. I appreciate talking to you, Marshall.
Yeah.
Well, thanks, Derek, for calling in.
Yeah,
and that's I really enjoyed your views of Winnipeg because, like I said, Derek, it's I've only. Like Marshall says, it's what's north of is Vancouver, and you just drive through Winnipeg as quickly as you can because I heard the mosquitoes were bigger than the crows out there, so you didn't want to stop, so you go through town and you go, I'll see you later. But thanks, Derek, for calling.
Oh, you're welcome, Derek.
Yeah. And getting back to Marshall, and you continue with Ian on with your hunting and skills and.
Yeah, well, basically, what we do is I guess the greatest joy I get is working with the young children, and we start working with the kids, I guess, when they're about 7 or 8 years old and getting them out on the hunt and, basically participating. And then usually, I guess we've had them start with ducks and geese at about 8 to 10 years of age. And last year was kind of interesting because I guess down here we had, the amount of snow geese that came in last fall was just phenomenal. I mean, there were fields down in Ladner where there was probably 10,000 snow geese in the field. And just watching the passion in the kids' eyes, can we go hunting? Can we go hunting?
Yeah.
And it's a bit like having, a dog on a lead, how they strain at it. And, can we go yet? Can we go yet? No, let them land. There's lots of time left. And, of course, to the kids, there's, no time like the present. And so they basically all got their geese, all had fun, and
good.
And
well, tell us, there's a terminology that probably our viewers, some might not understand. When we say the captain of the hunt, now the captain of the hunt started, can you give us just a little bit of brief history about, you know, how me?
Yeah, that, well,
that would
the first,
enlighten.
The first terminology that I can see to captain of the hunt was, go back to, I guess it's about the early 1800s, and the first captain or captain general of the hunt was Cuthbert Grant. And Cuthbert Grant, this is interesting, because, you know, I've done quite a bit of studying on Cuthbert Grant and basically what he did and what he got away with. And quite an interesting fellow, and of course there's been lots of books written on him. I don't think I'm going to write a book on him, but he was, along with, I believe, one of the other captains of the hunt at that time was Pangman. And, of course, the whole idea was, in those days, it was the buffalo hunt. And, again, you know, when people talk about, you know, traditional territories and that, you have to remember that although they were in the Forks and around Red River, that's not where they hunted buffalo. They'd go as far as Alberta, they'd go as far as Montana. And it was a big expedition. So, of course, what would happen is the captain of the hunt would organize it, and then each day of, you know, on the journey and then during the hunt, there'd be a captain of the day. And there'd be, you know, it actually goes back to a time that First Nations also had a similar thing, because you couldn't, if somebody started to run buffalo before everybody was ready, then basically you could have famine that year, because one person could scare the herd away before they got a chance to, you know, harvest the amount of animals. So there were rules to the hunt. Like, you couldn't, once you got out on the hunt, you couldn't leave, you know, and go back home unless you had permission of the captain and the officers of the hunt. And that there were penalties for theft. There were, all the instructions were laid out. It was very, very well organized. And the other interesting thing is that, in Alberta and Saskatchewan, when the buffalo were starting to disappear and become extinct, that it was the Métis who put in conservation measures far before, you know, any of the federal or provincial governments put it in. And, of course, that didn't help, because they basically pretty well drove the buffalo close to extinction. But, again, it's organized, but there's also what I call the spiritual aspect of the hunt. And every once in a while, the government gets up, and with firearms licensing and stuff like that, we'll talk about sustenance hunting. And the government doesn't have a very clear-cut definition of what sustenance is. And, of course, their idea is that, oh, you're on welfare, you can't afford to feed yourself, and therefore you've got to go out and hunt because, you have no money. And, you see, what we look at is sustenance. There's three parts to sustenance. You know, you sustain the body. That's understandable, but also there's a spiritual aspect to the hunt. So it also is, we're sustaining the spirit, and we're also sustaining our culture, and I think that's a very important part of it. That, you know, when we talk about sustenance, it's threefold.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, because I remember when I was applying for my license, one of the questions that they came over, and I said to her, she said to me, she says, how much money do you make? And I says, well, what does the money got to do with the fact that it's part of my culture and my history, and and she said, listen, do you want your license or don't you? She says, this is the whole thing. I couldn't believe it. She says, how much do you make? And I told her, of course, at the time I was doing a lot of volunteering for the museum, and I gave her this figure, and she says, well, then you qualify for being this hunter, the subsistence hunter. And I couldn't believe it.
Yeah, you have to be poor. You have to be poor to be a subsistence hunter.
Yeah, so didn't matter, but you know, the way she said that, do you want your license or not? Like, I mean, she was judging me over a phone at probably never even picked up a rifle before. It was amazing.
It's interesting, Dale, because I'm sort of seeing a resurgence in the interest in hunting. And more of the young people are talking about, I want control over the food I'm eating. You know, after we've had mad cow disease and we've had salmonella poisoning and we've got all these additives, antibiotics and growth hormones and everything put into meat, I'm getting people who say, I want to be responsible for my own diet. I want to know what I'm eating. And, you know, we find people who want to grow their own vegetables. We want people who want to eat organic and free range. And, I mean, what can be more organic and free range than game meat? Yeah.
Oh, yeah, there you go. So now that we've had this talk about the Captain of the Hunt, you have training classes that you do this, and how can we get in touch with you? Can you give us your email address where they can, the young Métis can get in touch with you, and if they have an interest in Métis harvesting and of course getting their license and doing it the way that we should be doing it properly, and give us some idea of what's on and how it gets started. And
well, I teach, I guess they started with the federal firearms licenses, and I always sort of joke, and I say, well, I think the first step is you need to get your firearms license unless you're going to hunt with a sharp stick or a big stone or something. And that's the first step, and it's a Canadian Firearms Safety Course, and that's the prerequisite for getting your firearms license. We teach those courses here in Vancouver, but I also am the a master Aboriginal instructor, and I've trained a lot of the Aboriginal firearms instructors in the province. So if a person's not from Vancouver, I can probably put them in touch with one of the Aboriginal instructors in the province here. And those the courses I have, of course, are in downtown Vancouver. To get a hunter number in British Columbia, you have to take the hunter safety course, which is known as CORE. We also teach that, but with a little different flavor that we do it in a traditional way. So, of course, we also cover preparing yourself for the hunt spiritually, physically, mentally, and, doing it according to Métis customs. Now, you can get hold of me. My email address is metis@telus.net, or you can give me a phone call at area code 604-730-0289. And they say we can either, tell you about the courses we have here in Vancouver, or I can put you in touch with somebody who teaches, outside of the Vancouver area.
Yeah. Well, this has been really a great program for you, Marshall, and I really appreciate you coming on. And if you don't mind, maybe in the future we can go into more of the hunting and some of the experiences you've had in British Columbia and things. Well, Marshall, I'd like to thank you very much for being our guest on Métis Voices Radio program.
Well, I really appreciate the opportunity, and it was nice to hear about old friends that we haven't touched base with for a while, like Earl and Derek and Dan out there, and hopefully it puts us back in touch and back into the loop, and I wish you and the program the best of luck, and participate whenever I can make it.
You betcha. Thanks a lot. I really enjoyed our visit with you. Thanks
I
a lot, Marshall.
Too. Okay,
beautiful.
Take care.
You take care now.
Okay, bye-bye.
I would like to thank you, the listeners, for tuning in, and our directors and our sponsors of the BBS radio station for allowing us to present this program to you each week. Just a little note, again, a reminder, there will be a memorial jam session for Patty Mayo at the Langley Legion Hall, British Columbia, Canada, on June 22nd 2008, beginning at 3 p.m. Be sure to give us your feedback about the Métis Voices radio show on the BBS webpage. Next week, Friday, June the 13th, we look forward to having our guest and another very good friend, elder Métis brother, Bob Ducharme, the president of the Métis Veterans Association of British Columbia. That should be a very good program. He's going to be talking about a lot of the veterans that the Métis have gone through, and that will be a very good program. So please stay tuned the same time, starting 7:55 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. Have a good week, and take care. Until then, Marcy.